I'm Moz Bloxon.
And I'm Elizabeth McQueen. And we are back with season 5 of Pause Play.
Like we never left. This season is all about change. Changes in the laws, climate change, tech, and ticket prices. I mean, the list goes on, really.
Yeah, and we're going to look at how all these changes impact the Austin music scene. The new season starts on April 17th, but you can catch up on all the other seasons at KUTX.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KUT
and KUTX
Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
There was very little, nearly nothing on historically black colleges. And so at the time I was at Florida Atlantic, and so I was like, man, FAMU was like right up the road. Well, you know, 8 hours away from my house. Mm-hmm. But I knew Jay Gaither was dominant. I'd heard these stories from my uncles, and I knew that he was a fantastic program. So I did a research trip, and I went up there, and they had the archivists there, and the librarians up in Florida A&M were amazing, and they gave me these materials and all these letters and documents. And so I had budgets and letters to professional teams, and I began to understand how he organized his football program. Because the issue, as was discussed in our panel today, that there wasn't a lot of research money, recruiting money, budgets were thin. Coach Gaither was the AD, coached basketball at one point. And those things, I thought those were kinds of stories. And that the greatness, that the success that he was able to produce was Willie Gallimore, Ken Riley, Bob Hayes. I wanted to understand how that was done. And I didn't want to chalk it up to that these were just natural athletes, that there was something being done, happening on these institutions that some coaches were better than others. And so I wanted to tell that story.
Dr. Derek E. White, Associate Professor of History and African American and Africana Studies at the University of Kentucky, and author of Blood, Sweat, and Tear, Jack Gaither, Florida A&M, and the History of Black College Football, published by University of North Carolina Press. During Super Bowl 54 week recently held in South Florida, more than 30 community events took place, but none more significant to the African-American community than celebrating the legacy and impact of HBCU football and the NFL. The African-American Research Library and Cultural Center and the Urban League of Broward County hosted student-athletes from area high schools for a panel discussion on the impact of HBCUs on football. Former and current NFL players participated, along with an NFL executive. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Historically Black Colleges and Universities and the NFL with Dr. Derek E. White. In Black America.
In their celebration of the 100th year, it was not as historical as we would like, right? I think for better or for worse, college football, who celebrated its 150th year, and in conjunction with ESPN primarily, had done these series of documentaries that kind of documented the game. So they did a great set of documentaries talking about the early game when the Ivy Leagues dominated college football, right? You get that kind of nostalgia. NFL is not so much, right? And that part of what gets lost is that the reintegration of the NFL, in part, is done because, you know, teams want to move to the West Coast, right? They want to play in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And that the black community, the LA Sentinel in particular, forced the LA Dons to say, if you want to come in, you got to desegregate your team. So Woody Strode gets an opportunity to play, and Kenny Washington gets a chance to try out for these teams, and they make these teams at the NFL. So we're talking about the reintegration of professional football.
As the National Football League celebrated its first 100 seasons, unbeknownst to many sports fans, the NFL didn't have any African-American players for a decade. From 1934 to 1946, there was an unspoken agreement between owners to ban African-American players. Today, there are 2 African-American general managers, 4 minority head coaches, and 1 chief operating officer. For the first time, the crew for Super Bowl 54 had a record number of minority officials. Of the 7 on the field, 5 were African-Americans. The contribution of historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, to the NFL has changed the game forever. Undrafted by an NFL team, Paul Tait Younger was the first African-American player from Grambling State University to play in the NFL when he signed with the Los Angeles Rams in 1949. The first African-American drafted in the NFL draft was George Rooks, a running back out of Morgan State in the 11th round, 125th overall, by the Green Bay Packers in 1951. During Super Bowl 54 week in South Florida, a group of area high school athletes had an opportunity to learn about the rich history of black college football and its contributions to the NFL. In Black America spoke with Dr. Derrick A. White, associate professor at the University of Kentucky.
When I was teaching a class on sports history, I found that the students knew nothing about historically black colleges. Right. So they were, as part of their assignment, they had to research the histories of the sports histories at various institutions. And students had Bethune-Cookman and Florida A&M. And I knew that those were really successful athletic programs. And students came back with nothing. And so I chalked it up initially that students were being students, that they just didn't do enough. But when I began to assist them, I realized there was a huge gap in the scholarship, and there's a lot of work on sports history, there's a lot of work on college sports, especially college football, but there was very little, nearly nothing on historically black colleges. And so at the time I was at Florida Atlantic, and so I was like, man, FAMU is like right up the road, well, 8 hours away from my house. Mm-hmm. But I knew Jay Gaither was dominant. I'd heard these stories from my uncles, and I knew that he was in a fantastic program. So I did a research trip, and I went up there, and they had the archivists there, and the librarians up at Florida A&M were amazing, and they gave me these materials, and all these letters and documents. And so I had budgets and letters to professional teams, and I began to understand how he organized his football program. Because the issue, as was discussed in our panel today, that there wasn't a lot of research money, recruiting money, budgets were thin. Coach Gaither was the AD, coached basketball at one point. And those things, I thought those were kinds of stories. And that the greatness, that the success that he was able to produce was Willie Gallimore, Ken Riley, Bob Hayes. I wanted to understand how that was done. I didn't want to chalk it up to that these were just natural athletes, that there was something being done, happening on these institutions that some coaches were better than others. And so I wanted to tell that story.
Talk to us about integration. Integration had a positive effect, but it also had a devastating effect on
kids
and also African-Americans going to the NFL.
Right. So integration was a boom for professional football, right? That, one of the reasons that Jay Gaither was so able to be so successful, especially early on in the 40s and early 50s, is that many of his former players got their degrees and became teachers in the high schools all across the state of Florida and North Georgia. And so they would just send him letters like, hey, Coach Gaither, I got this really good kid. This Willie Gallimore guy, he's pretty good, right? Like, this is how he got recruiting information, was from his former players. But those players were talented, but there was no professional football opportunities. And so when those opportunities really begin to open up, especially after 1960 when the AFL comes in, that mm-hmm. professional football now creates a new opportunity for black colleges and small colleges in general. And so that becomes this boom. And on the backside, the civil rights movement is happening at this exact same time, right? So Brown v. Board of Education, there's this entire push to desegregate schools, whether at the high school level, colleges, et cetera. And so in many ways, black colleges are kind of caught between their success, right? Mm-hmm. They're producing these great players in the NFL, many of them all pros, as we talked about earlier, 32 are in the NFL Hall of Fame. Right. At the same time, there are new opportunities at Florida or Miami or Georgia, and that these schools, especially in the Deep South, are slowly trying to recruit them.
When you look back at the history of HBCUs and its contribution to the NFL, I found it amazing in the 100th year of the league, there's very little that has been articulated about HBCUs or the early African-American players in the league.
Yeah, they in their celebration of the 100th year, it was not as historical as we would like, right? I think for better or for worse, college football, who celebrated its 150th year, right, and in conjunction with ESPN primarily, had done these series of documentaries that kind of documenting the game. So they did a great set of documentaries talking about the early game when the Ivy Leagues dominated college football, right? You get that kind of nostalgia.
Right. Mm-hmm.
NFL is not so much, right? And that part of what gets lost is that the integration, the reintegration of the NFL, Nashville in part is done because, you know, teams want to move to the West Coast, right? They want to play in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And that the black community, the LA Sentinel in particular, forced the LA Dons to say, if you want to come in, you got to desegregate your team. So Woody Strode gets an opportunity to play, and Kenny Washington gets a chance to try out for these teams, and they make these teams in the NFL. So we're talking about the reintegration of professional football. And I think they didn't do a great job. I mean, I think it was a missed opportunity. And I think that, you know, while NFL Films has been an amazing kind of reservoir of all the kind of history of the NFL, I think they missed an opportunity to tell this unique set of stories about the early players and to really kind of confront the racism that was embedded in NFL football that pushed Fritz Pollard and others out the league in the 1930s. I'm not going to spend too much time, but I do want to talk a little bit about the importance and history of historically black college football in wake of the Super Bowl that is happening here in South Florida this weekend. College football just recently celebrated its 150th season. Professional football just celebrated is in the current celebration of its 100th season. And one of the things that gets lost or has been discussed, if you've been paying attention to these stories, is the role of African-American athletes. In particular, because of segregation, that many of the black athletes that are celebrated by the NFL and college football were members of historically black colleges and universities. And so for many people who are aware of the landscape, and I know this is a home crowd, because I know many of your teachers are graduates of Bethune-Cookman, graduates of Florida A&M, graduates of Clark Atlanta or Morehouse and other historically black colleges, who are really shaping your lives in many ways. And so for you, many times when I sat in that exact same seat as a high school student in Lexington, Kentucky, many of my teachers, including my mom, are graduates of Kentucky State University. And so this is very much a project that was near and dear to my heart. Let me talk really quickly, because I don't have much time this morning. I want to say a couple things. That in 1979, the University of Miami traveled to Tallahassee to play Florida A&M. And on paper, and from the modern perspective, many people like yourselves, when I introduced this to students, assumed that this game would be a blowout. But Florida A&M won 16-13 on a goal line stand and a missed field goal in the last seconds of the game. And what's interesting is when I researched this, when I came across this story and the story of this game, what was most interesting to me was that the newspapers in Florida had Florida A&M as a favorite. And I saw that as a clue, right? This is a moment to think, what was happening that these knowledgeable sports writers, black and white, thought that Miami would lose to Florida A&M? And this opens up a whole history of black college football. That beginning in 1892, the first historically black college football game was played in North Carolina. And by the early 20th century, the game was brought to the state of Florida. And so in my book, I talk about three kind of things, because this is like you're in high school and people like to remember three things, right? So three things you could take away. The first piece of the book talks about what I call sporting congregations. How did and why did black colleges create athletic programs when they are struggling for money in a segregated educational system, relying on churches, donations, and philanthropy? And how do they do it, and how do they do it in such a successful manner? And they do this in a couple of ways, that these sporting congregations are really the reaction and the product of the work of former players, many of whom had played, as African Americans had played at Northern schools like Dartmouth or Colgate, who would come, could only get jobs as teachers at historically black colleges. It is a product of administrators who supported allow for student body to take up extracurricular activities besides debate, and said that their young men could go out and play tackle football.
We'll be back with more in Black America after this message.
Hi, my name is Sarah Ash, and I'm a reporter-producer for the Texas Standard. I usually would not call myself a sports fan, but I grew up watching soccer. One of my favorite stories I've reported looked at how women's soccer specifically is growing in popularity in Texas and across the country. Listen anytime to the Texas Standard, wherever you get your podcasts.
And now back to this episode of In Black America.
The third piece is that it required a vast and robust black community, in particular the black press, that black newspapers like the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, and others supported these emerging teams. And so as a coalition, these things formed a sporting congregation. This is probably most evident in Florida when, in 1933, Florida A&M creates the Orange Blossom Classic. Now, how many people have heard of the Florida Classic? All right. How many people have heard of the Orange Blossom Classic? Says I see my seasoned citizens, because the Orange Blossom Classic has not been played. But beginning in 1933, Florida A&M was not a very good football program. It had been playing kind of sporadically for two decades. That they decided that they were going to hold a bowl game or an exhibition game that would invite a team from another part of the country, in this case Howard University, down to Jacksonville to play this game. And in doing so, Howard was one of the elite institutions. It had an elite football program. It had previously won a national title 2 years before this game. And in doing so, they get Howard down to Jacksonville, and they're selling this black community in Jacksonville. And they support this game. FAMU wins the first game in an upset against Howard University. And the Orange Blossom Classic becomes the most important black college football classic in its existence from 1933 into the early 1970s. In 1947, the Orange Blossom Classic will move to Miami. And so we see the creation of this sporting congregation coming to fruition, right? The black community in South Florida will move the game here. It will be the first black community, black team to play in the Orange Bowl in 1947. In fact, how many of you guys have played in Traz Powell Stadium? Almost all of you, right? Never won there, okay. Does anybody know who Traz Powell is, though? A black man, okay. That's a point. Anybody else? A two-time All-American at Florida A&M, who was a longtime coach in Miami at George Washington Carver. He also caught the first touchdown scored the first touchdown in the Orange Bowl. So he's a legacy here in South Florida. So after this sporting congregation allows for schools of all sorts, whether it's Florida A&M or Howard University or Tennessee State or Jackson State or Prairie View, to establish this network and support college athletics, in particular college football, what we see is what I call the second part of my project, which is the golden age of black college football. That after World War II, which ends in 1945 to 1970, HBCUs were the best college football programs in the country. And I know that's hard to see, but when you ask your teachers who are familiar with these programs, they will tell you that there's a reason that LSU did not want to play Grambling. There is a reason that Florida A&M and University of Florida never got an opportunity to meet. Because the coaches, both black and white, fully anticipated that the black colleges were better. So how did they become so good? Well, they had these legendary coaches, right? And they had created this network that had first gave birth to the game, and now it began to bear fruit. And so Coach Gaither at Florida A&M used to brag that, you know, and when it came time to recruiting, he just sent one coach down one side of the state of Florida, the other coach down the other, and they would bring back all the best players in the state of Florida, and they would all be Rattlers. And this dynamic allowed for Florida A&M in particular to become one of the most dominant programs in the country after World War II. And so this golden age is an important moment. This is the moment when we think about all the great players. In fact, Larry Little, who will come out here in a little bit, is on the tail end of this golden age of black college football. This is where we see Bob Hayes, Buck Buchanan, right? Men who are in the Hall of Fame, who were stars in HBCU football. And one of the reasons that we know that this was the golden age, and that I make the claim, is that professional football takes notice. That the Kansas City Chiefs are playing in their first Super Bowl since 1970. Go 49ers. Is that what you're saying over here? And one of the reasons that the Kansas City Chiefs was able to go to two Super Bowls in the late 60s, three Super Bowls in the late 60s, is that they had found a secret ingredient and a secret strategy that allowed them to be extremely successful. That they were the most aggressive professional football team when it came to recruiting, signing, and drafting players from historically black colleges. And so the last time that they were here in the Super Bowl in 1970, that 13 members of their 13 players were from HBCUs, including Buck Buchanan and Willie Lanier, both of whom are in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Now, when the Pro Football finds out that black colleges have tremendous athletes, players like Bob Hayes, Buck Buchanan, and others, the predominantly white colleges, because of the Civil Rights Movement and because of the desire to win football games, begin to, in the South, predominantly white colleges begin to slowly recruit African Americans. The University of Miami is the first in the state of Florida to recruit a player in 1966. University of Florida will follow suit by 1969. And across the South, that African Americans now have a choice. They can go to Florida A&M. They can go to University of Miami. They could go to Notre Dame. They could go to Michigan State. They could go to Southern. And these choices allow for the large, predominantly white institutions to use their resources to their advantages. They're able to wine them, they dine them, to recruit them, to use illegal inducements in some cases, to encourage them to come to their institutions. And what we see is the slow seepage of talent, the losing of talent in historically black colleges. In addition, we also see that generation of great coaches slowly begin to fade away. Jay Gaither retires. Billy Nix retires. Henry Arthur King dies. So these men who had molded generations of, during the golden age have begun to pass away. And so others like Eddie Robinson will continue on until the 1990s. John Merritt will continue on at Tennessee State until the 1980s. That these men are not able to stop the tide of talent leaving historically black colleges. Jay Gaither would say, he says that he believes in integration. He just believes that the method is wrong. And he saw this, that it had undermined this. He had spent his whole life at Florida A&M from 1937 to 1969 as a coach. And he saw that this program that he had worked so hard to build began to be undermined by integration.
Talk to us about Lamar Hunt.
Lamar Hunt is, it is amazing. He, you know, his Chiefs are in the Super Bowl this week. And I've said this in my project. I was like, man, Lamar Hunt, it makes no sense. He's the son of an oil man from Texas.
Right.
And he is the one who embraces black college athletics, black athletes in general, but black college athletes in particular. Like, and one of the things I kind of talk about in my book, that there were teams that were like, we're going to recruit black players. That's a, kind of an advantage. But they were only recruiting if they went to, you know, Michigan State or Notre Dame or UCLA. And so he really leaned in and recruited HBCU players. In particular, he hires the first black scout for him is Lloyd Wells, who was a former reporter from the Houston Informer. And Lloyd Wells had all these connections. He had been an athlete, student athlete at Prairie View, and was close friends with Otis Taylor's famous case. And so he's one who's given, you know, as a part-time scout initially and a kind of confidant to both Hank Stram and Lamar Hunt, he's given him information about Buck Buchanan. And I think, and that's the thing. And so when they draft Buck Buchanan number one in 1963, that changes the game, and that he's a star from the very beginning. And I think it's telling that the AFL drafted him number one in 63, and I think he was drafted in the fifth or sixth round in the NFL, right? So there's such a huge discrepancy in terms of the way his talent was viewed. And so Lamar Hunt was many ways of maverick in terms of really kind of pushing away the kind of his kind of the racism that was he grew up with in Texas as a kind of elite oil man. He had no prior experience that that suggested that this is the kind of path that he would do, but he was competitive and that he saw this as a competitive advantage, and he really leaned into it. And it was an opportunity for all black colleges.
Why is it important for young African-American athletes to know that they can take it to the next level attending an HBCU?
Well, I think that the black colleges do, they have been, as one of my friends, his new book's called Shelter in a Time of Storm, right? Mm-hmm. That black colleges have served our communities for many decades and many, since we've been here, right? I owe my own success. My mom's mm-hmm. a Kentucky State graduate. My guidance counselors have went to Kentucky State. And so I understood that role, right, not just as an athletic role, but as a community role, the role that black professors, I know that, if you go to a historically black college, the odds of you having black professors on a consistent basis are much greater than they
exactly.
are.
Better than
50%, right? It's much greater than it is at many other institutions, despite all the discussions about diversity and diversity initiatives. And so I think there's something, there's something besides resources. And I described it in my book as human resources, that mm-hmm. black colleges have human resources. They, and that makes up, it doesn't completely make up, but they lack some material resources, mm-hmm. but they try to make up for it in human resources. Whereas other institutions have abundant material resources. But if no one can thinks that you can learn or that you don't belong there, that you can have a terrible negative experience that those resources cannot fix. And so I think that that's one of the things I wanted to see. And I think athletics is a way of understanding that. Plus, it has that history
right.
of greatness, both in basketball and in track and field and as well as in football.
Being a Floridian, what is it about the athletic prowess of African-American athletes in this state? Particularly football.
If I knew the answer, I would.
I would
retire, right? It would be my own Gatorade, right?
Right.
No, I think that I think that some of it's about weather.
Okay.
I think that there's something about that Florida is a very outdoor experience, mm-hmm. especially for working class African Americans. It's still an outdoor space. The kids okay. still go outside in the heat. Mm-hmm. They run, they play. I think that if we look at the park system, the schools,
okay.
we still have a lot of, desegregation happened in the state, but there's these pockets of what we think of as formerly. So Booker T. Washington is still here, right?
Like mm-hmm.
some of these schools, Dillard is still here. Ely is these schools that have become, that were initially predominantly black
mm-hmm.
and become integrated and then remain predominantly black because of white flight and other things. And I think that those schools provide kind of opportunities. We see this in Tallahassee at both FAMU and Lincoln. You see this at other schools across the state. And so I think there's something to be said about it. But I don't know what the magic potion is. I mean, there's a stat I think I saw that Lake Okeechobee, mm-hmm. those two high schools produce more professional football
right.
players.
Yeah, exactly.
And they, they blame it on the muck and, they think mm-hmm. is that, and there may be some science to that. I also think that for me, I'm leery of those kinds of discussions, if only mm-hmm. because it has a certain kind of naturalism that black people are somehow natural athletes.
Okay, right.
But I do think that sports are serious here, and at mm-hmm. places where sports are serious, that you see the product of that. And I think that that's kind of the way. And so for Larry Little's generation, it was a way mm-hmm. out, a way to go
right.
to college, right?
Right?
How do you get to college? That was the way. And then it was a way to get, into the NFL and out of out of kind of working class, lower class circumstances. And so I still think it has that kind of hold over that as a mechanism. And kids, when I taught at FAU, they say, well, I want to play in the NFL because I understand that. I don't know a lawyer or engineer or mm-hmm. things. And so I think those kinds of dynamics are still at play.
Any criticism from your colleagues about this book?
Not at all. It's been really well received. I think it has been, I've been very pleased with the support I've gotten from the University of North Carolina Press and mm-hmm. I've, my former colleagues at Dartmouth and my current colleagues at the University of Kentucky. No one has anything to say negative. I mean, other than the normal kind of reviews that you get about a book, but it's been really positive. It's glowing. It fits. There have been a couple other books that came out between the time I started, mm-hmm. but this one I feel like is the most kind of historical and kind of robust in terms of kind of filling in the broader history and contextualizing sports. So it's about civil rights movement, it's about sports, it's about black communities. All those things are kind of intertwined, and that's one of the things I try to do.
Dr. Derek E. White, Associate Professor of History and African American and Africana Studies at the University of Kentucky and author of Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Jack Gaither, Florida A&M, and the History of Black College Football. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
In Black America and KUT Public Radio are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters, helping to bring diversity to the airwaves. You can find more shows like In Black America in the NPR Network in your favorite podcast app. I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr.
Do brain games really make me smarter? What is all this screen time doing to my brain? How do I protect my brain as I age? Find the answers to life's most and least pressing questions about your mind with the Two Guys on Your Head podcast. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts.